as you pointed out, I studied psychology in undergrad, and I have a friend who now is a PsyD who would often point out that a lot of young rabbis study psychology when they're in NYU. The most common tracks, although I know Dr. Karish's son, Rabbi Phil, studied biology, most of the guys are usually studying either psychology or accounting, and they call it psych for smicha. But a friend of mine pointed out that any rabbi who thinks that getting an undergraduate degree in psychology will qualify him to practice psychology in any way, shape, or form is kidding himself, and it's arguably even irresponsible. So I don't know very much about psychology, but I do know a lot about psychological research. The only thing you really get a degree in when you study psychology undergrad is not the practice of psychology, but the theory. And so what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about the theory of psychology. And that's what I'm very excited to share with you. And we're going to talk about something that it's not quite a syndrome, it's not quite a disease or any sort of psychological ailment. It is not officially in the DSM-5, but it's something significant that we all need to spend a little bit of time thinking about. But before we can get into our psychological topic, we got to start in our parsha, because in the parsha we encounter one of the most monumental scenes in Jewish history. We see Moshe Rabbeinu and the Jewish people standing at the Yam Suf, standing at the Red Sea, and they are quite literally between a rock and a hard place. They are between an Egyptian army charging at them and a roaring sea in front of them. I've posted the source sheet in the chat for those who would like to follow along. But I'm not going to share my screen. We're just going to learn together. Because in the beginning of our parsha, in the first and second Aliyahs, we see this conundrum that Bnei Israel is in. And they call out to Moshe Rabbeinu. What does Moshe Rabbeinu do? Like we would imagine, like we would expect of ourselves, he turns to a Kadosh Baruch Hu and starts davening. And what does the Kadosh Baruch Hu say? This is such an unthinkable response from a Kadosh Baruch Hu when Bnei Yisrael are not only Be'ez Tzara, but in the Exodus story that a Kadosh Baruch Hu has laid out, that is seemingly meticulously planned. There's probably a whole board with lots of strings in a Kadosh Baruch Hu's office with all the expectations that he has to accomplish this goal of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And so Moshe calls out to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And what does a Kadosh Baruch Hu say? In Perek Yedalad, Pasuk Tesvav, 14:15, we have it in both bold and, thank God, in color in blue. Vayomar Hashem Moshe, Mati Tzak Eli. Moshe, what are you calling out to me for? Daber Ben Yisrael V'yisoh. Just go. And we're sitting here, we're reading this, and we're thinking, what do you mean, just go? Where's Moshe supposed to go? What's he supposed to do? And the Ramban elaborates on this instruction even further, and elaborates on why this pasuk is so hard for us to understand. The Ramban says on the same place that it's not just that Moshe called out to a Kadosh Baruch Hu because he was nervous. Rather, we're going to start in the middle of this Ramban at the blue arrow, Rabbi Seinu Amru in the Mechilta. He's going to quote Chazal saying, "Shehaya Moshe tzoik u'mispalel v'hu nachon." Moshe correctly called out to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. God saying Mati Tzak Eli, and the Ramban says that Moshe was doing the right thing. Ki lo yada ma yaseh. He genuinely did not know what to do in this moment. V'afo pisha amar lo Hashem ve'echav davar paron. Even though God told him, "Oh, I'm going to harden Paro's heart." Hu lo haya yodeya ech yisnahi. He didn't know what he should be doing right now at this moment. Ki hu al svas hayam v'hasone rodefu masig. Because Paro is chasing after him. And he says, "God, just tell me what to do." Now the Ramban is pointing out something here that maybe we never thought about. Until this point, basically for the past 2.5 parshios, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given Moshe an outline plan, line for line, what's going to happen. It's almost a screenplay, if you will, where he tells Moshe, you're going to say this to Paro, and Paro's going to respond that way, and you're going to say this, and he's going to say that. You're going to do this, he's going to do that. And Moshe knows exactly what to expect. Except, explains the Ramban here, that at the Yam Suf, Moshe's looking at his script, and it doesn't say anything. He can't figure out what his next move is. And so he turns to God and says, "Kadosh Baruch Hu, please, 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 tell me what comes next. What's the next line? I didn't get the copy of the script for this week." And God says, "What are you calling out to me for? What are you bothering me for, Chalila?" And it's hard to understand. It's hard to appreciate what God's thinking. What's God trying to accomplish by telling Moshe, "Mati Tzak Eli, why are you calling out to me?" And we're going to pause the Ramban right here. Because this challenge that Moshe Rabbeinu is facing is something that we can all really appreciate. And I think if anyone were in that situation, they would likely feel the same way. They would likely feel at a loss. They don't have their script in front of them. But it's possible, maybe, that Moshe Rabbeinu is not just experiencing this as the leader of Am Yisrael, but Moshe Rabbeinu is experiencing this as an individual. And his concern and his worry, his tzaka, his shouting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is actually coming from somewhere else. But before we do that, let's look at a curious situation that I think actually connects quite well. I want to introduce you to someone named Annie Duke. Now, Annie Duke, not anymore. Now Annie Duke is an accomplished author, but Annie Duke back in the day was a poker player. And while, you know, poker is not exactly, you know, the number one activity of nice Jewish men and women, we don't necessarily endorse or encourage gambling. You can imagine that poker is a game that requires some level of expertise. You can't get lucky so many times. There is a level of chance, but poker is a skill set. So much so that for whatever reason, ESPN has decided that even though they're the entertainment sports programming network, they're also going to feature the World Series of Poker, which makes it sound much more impressive than just a bunch of people sitting around the table. But it requires a skill set. And so Annie Duke spends 10 years playing poker professionally. And in 2004, she enters the World Series of Poker. And like, you know, light exhibition games of poker, people don't get so excited about. But the World Series, for some reason, ESPN puts it on and people watch it. And Annie Duke, in an interview with NPR, talked about what it was like for her to be on display, for her to be in this poker match that's going to be broadcast on live TV. And, you know, with the cameras and everyone watching, Annie Duke actually expressed great concern. She says, at the top of page 2, "I went in there with this incredible fear that my play was in front of the cameras would prove that everyone was right, that I was actually a terrible player, despite the fact that I had spent the last 10 years making my living playing poker at the highest levels of the game, that I didn't really deserve to have ever won anything, that I was bad, and that I had just gotten lucky, and everyone would know it." Annie Duke that year made history as the first woman to ever win the World Series of Poker. Annie Duke was the best poker player in 2004. And yet she goes into this match not saying, "Oh, I'm nervous that, you know, maybe the other contestants are going to beat me, that they're better than I am. This is my first time in this show." No, no, no. She's worried that she is a fraud, that she's going to be caught as having been faking it this whole time. And we're left to wonder, where in the world is Annie Duke getting this from? Why would she think that she's not good at playing poker, that she just got lucky for 10 years? No one's that lucky. She's obviously a good player, and yet there's something happening here. And I think it doesn't just happen with Annie Duke. We'll come back to Moshe Rabbeinu now, because Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't just call out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, doesn't just experience what seems to be somewhat of a crisis at the Yam Suf when things are very high pressure. But even when things are low pressure, when there's no one yelling at him, when it's just a conversation between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Moshe Rabbeinu, we see a similar doubt in Moshe's mind. Because if we look at their first conversation in Perek Dalad, it might be Perek Gimel, but Perek Dalad, we see that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is talking to Moshe. He wants Moshe to become the leader of Bnei Yisrael. This is back in Sefer Shmos, in Parsha Shmos. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, "Lo ish tvarim anochi. I'm not a man of words. I can't do this. I can't lead Bnei Yisrael out of Egypt." And Rashi comments there that it's not just, "Oh, I'm not a man of words. I wasn't yesterday. I'm not today." Moshe Rabbeinu spent a week, 7 full days, standing there arguing with a bush, arguing with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, saying, I can't lead the Jewish people out of Egypt. It's not for me. I'm not your guy." Who is your guy? Aaron Cohen. But Moshe Rabbeinu is not saying, "Oh, Aaron should be leading the Bnei Yisrael." Rashi reads it into it. The Midrashim read into it that Moshe is deeply concerned about slighting his older brother, who was the current Gadol HaDor, the current leader of Am Yisrael. The Psukim seem to tell us that Moshe Rabbeinu is nervous about himself. He says, I can't do it. I'm not good enough to be the leader of Bnei Yisrael, to take the Jewish people out of Egypt. And again, we're left to wonder, who's Moshe kidding? Kadosh Baruch Hu told him he's going to do it. Kadosh Baruch Hu says, "Moshe, I think that you'll be the man for the job." So why is Moshe questioning God? If God asked me to do something, if God says jump, I would say how high. I would assume that if God's telling me to do it, then he probably knows that I can do it. Maybe he knows me better than I know me. But for some reason, Moshe Rabbeinu is not experiencing that. Moshe Rabbeinu fights with him this time, spends a week saying no, and then later on, at the end of Parsha Shmos, after his first attempt with Parah did not go well, he says, "Ani aras vasayim." He goes back to the same point. "I'm not a good speaker. I can't enunciate. I can't speak well," and says it twice, in both in Perek Vav, both in Pasuk Yud Beis, and again in Lamed. "Ani aras vasayim." I'm impaired of speech. "I'm not your guy. Please don't make me do this because I can't." And so Moshe, at the start of his leadership of Bnei Yisrael, is seemingly very, very nervous, very, very cautious. He doesn't want to lead Bnei Yisrael, but not just because he doesn't want to slight his brother Aaron, but because he seems to have some personal insecurity. And it's not just any duke. And Lahavdil, it's not just Moshe Rabbeinu, but it even happens generations after Moshe Rabbeinu with King Shaul. Now, King Shaul, we're currently in the Ida Crown Jewish Academy. Thank you so much to them for lending me their conference room. But if we were to go into some of the classrooms, maybe we'd see a chart that I saw growing up. Because the chart that I saw growing up, it was a purple chart, and it basically had the kings of Yisrael and the kings of Yehuda, the two kingdoms that split, and the years that they were kings. But on the very top, before the kingdom split, you know, you had Shaul, and you had David HaMelech, and you had Shlomo, and the years that they were kings. And for Shlomo, it said 40 years. For David HaMelech, it said 40 years. And for Shaul HaMelech, how long was Shaul HaMelech king? Now it's a machlokas, exactly how long, but effectively, 2 years. Maybe a little bit longer. Shaul HaMelech is not king of Bnei Yisrael for very long. And it's shocking that he's not king for very long. Because if we look at how the Navi describes Melech Shaul, this is our guy. This is the king we're looking for. We see in Perek Yud, in Perek Tes, Pasuk Yud, Velohaya ben Ushmo Shaul, and Kish had a son named Shaul, Bakur Tov, when he was a good boy, Ve'ain Ish B'Bnei Yisrael Tov Mimenu, and there was no one better than him. Mishko V'mala, and he was head and shoulders above everyone, Mikol Ha'am. Not just head and shoulders in physically, but seemingly head and shoulders in every sense. He was just far and wide. He was always two steps ahead of everyone. He was the top. He was the king. It's interesting that the language of Mishko V'mala is used, you know, that he was head and shoulders above everyone. Rav Shimshon Pinkus, in his Sefer Shabbos Malkasa, explains why keser, why crown, is something that exists in kings and queens. Why do you put a crown on the heads of royalty? It says because what a crown does is it extends a person a little higher. You know, right now, we'll say 5'8". But if you put a crown on me, I'll jump 2 inches. Now I am in some ways taller, higher than everyone else, and it's made me bigger. And if you're taller than everyone, seemingly you're more fitting to be king. We see that colloquially in the modern day that, you know, CEOs, the people in charge of big companies, like 80-90% of them are above a certain height. We're very excited that our newborn is in the 93rd percentile of height, and we're hoping that one day he'll be. He'll be as tall as his namesake, his great-grandfather, who was 6'2". And the Zuckers aren't so tall, but the Barry side of the family has a little bit more height. Maybe one day our little Chaim Zev will be a CEO. But anyway, sorry. So we see that David HaMelech is Mishkol HaMelech. He is above everyone. He looks like a king. He acts like... He's got all the attributes of a king. And we would think, this guy's supposed to be a king. And then we see in Perek Yud, in Chaf Aleph, that Shaul comes, that he appoints Shaul HaMelech king, and all the people are looking around for their king, and they're looking, they can't find him. They don't know where Melech Shaul is. He's been anointed. He's gotten the oil spilled on his head. Shmuel Hanavi, who was at that moment the leader of Bnei Yisrael, the Gadol Ador, says, "Shaul, you're going to be king of Bnei Yisrael." And everyone's looking for him, and they don't know where he is. Where is he? But Yishalu Od Ba'Hashem Hava Od Halom Ish. Where is this guy? Where is this king you're telling us about? And Hashem has to tell him. No one can find him. God has to divine and tell them. He's hiding amongst the kelim. He's hiding in the baggage. He's hiding in the courtroom. Oh, this guy that you want to be king, that you're told to be king, who's got all the kohos and the kelim to become the king of Bnei Yisrael? Yeah, he's over hiding in the back, in the courtroom. And still the people run in Achav Gimel. They run to him, Vayigbah Nikola Am Mishkol V'mala, and they hold him up. And this guy, he's taller than everyone. He's bigger than everyone. It's so clear to everyone in the room that Shaul HaMelech is supposed to be the Melech. He's supposed to be the Melech of all of Bnei Yisrael. And Shmuel says, El Kol Am Haresem Asher Bachar Bo Hashem. Look at this person that HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose. Ki Ein Kamohu B'Kol Am. There's no one like Shaul HaMelech in our nation. Vayaru kol ha'am, and the entire nation, you know, they shout, they acclaim, they're all excited. Vayamru yechi ha'melech, long live the king. It is so clear that Bnei Yisrael is excited, that Shmuel is excited, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is excited, and they all want Shaul HaMelech to be king. And yet, where was Shaul HaMelech? He was hiding in the courtroom. He wasn't around. He didn't want to be king. Why did Shaul HaMelech not want to be king? Why was he pretending like he wasn't king when he'd already been crowned? And so we see these three examples. We see Moshe Rabbeinu, who's hesitant at the sea. He's hesitant when he first gets the job. We see Shaul HaMelech, who doesn't seem to want to fill the role as king, even though he's clearly the most fitting for it. And we see in the modern day, this woman, Annie Duke, in 2004, who was the best poker player in the world, and yet was nervous that she was going to be found to be a fraud. Looks like all of these things can be resolved through a psychological concept, albeit not a formal disease. It's not in the DSM. It's not in the official handbook of psychology. But it seems like all of these things can be explained through something called imposter syndrome. Now, imposter syndrome was first coined by Dr. Pauline Clance and Suzanne Imes in 1978. And these are two women who were accomplishing in their career. They were doing well, but still, they felt like frauds. They felt like a fake. They felt that somehow they hoodwinked, or through some sort of serendipity, they'd wound up in their, you know, top-notch jobs. But in the normal order of things, it never would have happened. And we also see, and then again, you know, 7 years later, in 1985, two other women, Dr. Joan C. Harvey, and Cynthia Katz, published a book, the first book of its kind, called If I'm So Successful, Why Do I Feel Like a Fake? And it was about this idea of imposter syndrome. Now, if you Google imposter syndrome, you search it on Amazon, you will see tons and tons and tons of books. But, oh my God, 45 years ago, this was the first. And in it, they describe, as the quote we see on our page, on the bottom of page 3, that imposter syndrome is a pattern rooted in intense, concealed feelings of fraudulence when faced with achievement tasks. I feel like I'm not supposed to be here. I might have accomplished. I might be in a top place, but it's not me. I'm not supposed to be filling this role. You feel like you don't belong. You feel like an imposter. And so you could be eminently qualified, but you don't feel like you are. And 70% of people, the research says, at some point in their lives, feel this way. It might not be for their whole lives. It might just be for, you know, for a brief period of time. It might be in one particular area where they're like, why are people asking me questions? I don't know anything about this. Why am I getting this? I don't know what's going on. A third of people feel it for the majority of their lives, that most of their lives, they're quote-unquote faking it till they make it, because they assume that they're not qualified. And so we see it. You know, if it's the context of education, that, you know, someone receives a prestigious fellowship, and they get into a great program, and they assume that, oh, no, the reason why I got in is not because I'm academically gifted, but because it was random, they were checking off a box, whatever the reason was, the motivation of the university to let me in. And maybe, you know, when it comes to work, it's not that I really deserve to have gotten this position, but I just keep getting lucky, and like I'm in the right place at the right time, and no one realizes, and no one's figured out that I don't actually know what I'm doing in my career. Or maybe when it's come to parenting, and this for some people is very troubling. And, you know, when someone first becomes a parent and they're like, why do people keep calling me mommy? I'm not a mommy. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I have a friend who in the hospital right now with COVID. God willing, he's doing well. But Michael Saltzman, he should have a refuah shleima. He commented to me after his first kid. He's like, in order to get my license, I had to take a class. I had to pass a test. I had to spend hours in the car with a trained instructor. Then another 100 hours with just a parent practicing driving, then another test to ensure that all the lessons that I learned actually stuck in and I know how to drive. And yet when it comes to taking care of a human life, basically we just had the kid, the nurses gave him to me and said, good luck. And so it's a cute joke, and Michael Salton's very funny, but it's not so crazy. That parents do this, parents are supposed to be this kind of person, and I'm not, I'm a kid, I'm a nothing. I don't know how to take care of another human being. And so many people, particularly when they start being parents, feel like imposters. And finally, I guess, maybe for some of the people in this group, I know we have some highly distinguished community members here, you know, it's possible that someone might feel, you know, when they get honored at a dinner, that they say, they don't really want to honor me. I haven't actually done very much. I'm not so chashev, I'm not so important. The reason they're honoring me is because everyone else said no, and so I'm the yutz who said yes. But it's not that they really wanted to honor me. I'm not really deserving of it. And while this might be something that some of us can relate to, it's not exclusive just to, you know, regular people, you know, the everyman. It applies even to people at the highest level of achievement. And on page four, we're not going to read all of them inside, but it applies to Albert Einstein, to Maya Angelou, you know, to Michelle Obama. These are people who were unquestionably extraordinarily successful, and yet all of them, in one way, shape, or form, felt inadequate, felt like they were just kind of tricking people, and at one point people were going to realize that they weren't as impressive as they seemed. And so it's not just one-third of people, it's not just 70% of people at some point in time, but everyone, no matter what sociological level you live in, no matter what level of achievement you've reached, no matter what level in your field you're at, everyone in some way, shape, or form seems to encounter or be hit by this feeling of inadequacy, this feeling of being an imposter. And we see it most strongly with Shaul HaMelech. Because as we said, Shaul HaMelech's kingship doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. Because when Shaul HaMelech, he was Mishkav HaMala, he was above everyone. He was the prime candidate. Everyone loved him. Everyone wanted Shaul HaMelech to be our king. And yet he only lasted 2 years? Maybe it's because, as we see in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Tesvav, Shmuel is now basically yelling at Shaul after he's already made too many mistakes and he can no longer be redeemed. He basically says, sorry, not Tezayin, Yudzayin. V'yemar Shmuel, halo im katona ta b'yanecha rosh shiftei Yisrael ata v'im shakacha Hashem l'melech Yisrael. Shaul HaMelech, you still don't seem to understand. You look at yourself like you're small. You think that you're insignificant. But you're not. You're the king of Israel. HaKadosh Baruch Hu crowned you king. And sometimes we're faced with this feeling of inadequacy, this feeling of being an imposter. And yet, it's all in our minds. It's not real. And that's what Shmuel is yelling at Shaul about. And it didn't just happen to Shaul HaMelech, but it happened to Annie Duke. It happened to, as we said, Maya Angelou, Albert Einstein, Michelle Obama. And it happens, maybe, we could suggest, to Moshe Rabbeinu, that he felt like an imposter at the beginning of his time leading B'nai Yisrael. And so if that's what we're facing, that's what we're dealing with, how do you get past imposter syndrome? Because I've done some research on it, and a lot of people have a lot to say about imposter syndrome, and I have not found such concrete, compelling ways to get around it. A lot of people say, yeah, everyone feels this way, so don't feel so bad. That's not good enough for me. I want something real. I want genuine guidance. And so while learning, actually, I have a conversa with Dr. Karish's son, Howard Karish, who I think gave share last week. He and I spent time learning Alei Shor, the Musar works of Rav Shlomo Volbe. Rav Volbe passed away in 2005. He was one of the big Balei Musar of the previous century. He was a Mashgiach in Yeshivas Beis Yaakov. And his two monumental works are Alei Shor, Chelek Aleph and Beis. And he was just incredible. He was asked to speak all over Israel. He was the Mashgiach. And at the end of his first shar, he puts a few letters that he received from his students. And his student reaches out to him and he says, Rebbe, I'm having a tough time. And that's what we see on page 5. And effectively, his Talmud says, Rebbe, I'm not doing well. I'm having a tough time, I'm not learning well. And, you know, in the context of yeshiva, not doing well means that you don't learn well. But in the context of family, maybe it means that you're not smiling, you're not laughing as much, you're too serious all the time. Maybe in the context of work, you're not accomplishing the things you want. You're not making the sales that you were supposed to. You're not covering the data you're supposed to. And maybe in the context of a relationship, you're not engaging the way that you want to. And in the context of tefillah, or davening, or avodas Hashem, we're not as invested, as engaged, as focused on mitzvos. And so it's not just about learning yeshiva when Rav Volbe speaks. His specific examples are about learning, but we can zoom out to almost anything. Rav Volbe's insights were so sharp, so keen, that it really can apply to anyone. Modern day psychologists have looked back at Rav Volbe and said that he really, really, really got it. His advice is on par, if not better, than some of the leading psychological insights of even today. And so when Rav Volbe gets a letter from his student talking about Limud She'eino Holech, it's not going well. Page 36, the Mechtav Sheni from Rav Volbe, he says, he's explaining what it's like for the Talmud. The Talmud is, he's not learning well, and he's, And particularly because he's sitting around yeshiva and he sees all his friends and all of his colleagues, if you will, his coworkers, his family members, and they're all doing so well. And they're understanding what they're supposed to understand. They're spending the time doing what they're supposed to be doing. And this student, it just like doesn't feel like he's doing very much. He's not as smart as that one. And he's not as sharp as that one. And he's not as studious as that one. And he's so aware of everyone else's kohos around him that he starts to feel bad about his own kohos. And so Revolbi says that, you know, this experience, it's debilitating. If we look at the last line of the second paragraph, he says, lo kishrum v'lo hatzlacha v'lo tikva, that you feel like you've got no strength, you've got no ability to success, you've got no hope. Rak, what are you left with when you see so many people around you succeeding? Afisas koach atzvus tsar. You're waning of your strength, you're sad, and you're in pain. And Revolbi, he tells a student that it's okay. This mida of yours is actually called kina. You don't feel bad because everyone's better than you. Feel bad because you feel like you're not good enough, and you wish you were that good. You wish you were as good as everyone else. It's jealousy. But that should be okay. That should be a comfort for you, because as a young man, and really as anyone who wants to grow, whether it's in their career, whether it's they want to succeed in their families, whether it's they want to grow spiritually, both learning and davening or whatever the mitzvah is, and if we want to be growing, then it's normal to feel this kind of jealousy. And so that's okay. And while Revolbi says that this is called jealousy, if we think about the symptoms, think about the experience that this person's having, maybe we could suggest that Revolbi's not just talking about jealousy. In a more modern parlance, we could suggest that this student's feeling like an imposter. This student is looking around at the yeshiva. This student is looking around at the environment he's in and saying, I don't belong here. Everyone else is so much better than I am. And so the student says, I'm not doing well. And Revolbi says, you have imposter syndrome. You feel like an imposter? But that's okay, because everyone feels like an imposter. He doesn't use the exact numbers, but 70% of people feel like an imposter at some point in their lives. That's normal. The number actually goes up to 85, but 70 is a little bit more conservative. And how does he end? The advice that he gives to his student is in this last paragraph. Habor yisparach in arotza. God doesn't want shekol b'nei adam yistaklu b'torah b'oso mabat, that everyone looks at Torah in the same way. V'yalamdu b'oso derek, and they learn the same way. V'yavinu oso dover, and they understand the same things. Ela kol echad b'gisha shelo. Everyone should be learning. Everyone should be interacting with Torah mitzvos in their own personal way, in their own personal style. L'vi kishron osov, with their kokos, with their abilities. Shelo v'yegia miyukadeslo, and with the amount of effort that they're able to put in. V'az kulam yachad yizaku l'Torah shlema. And then everyone collectively then will be able to receive the Torah. Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want us to try to be like someone else, to try to act like someone else, to try and emulate someone else's abilities. He wants us to just embody our own. And the Revolbi ends the piece with a story from Rav Naftali of Amsterdam, one of the prime students of Yisrael Salanter, where he says, Rebbe, if I had the brain of the Shagas Aryeh and the midos of the Sover Sharasha Avoda and Rebbe's Yira Shemayim, then I could serve a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And Rav Yisrael Salanter says, no, Rav Naftali, you don't understand. Kadosh Baruch Hu wants you to serve him with your kohos, with your mind, with your heart, and with your Yerushalayim. Not mine, not anyone else's. And so when you look around the other people, you see their strengths, that shouldn't mean a thing to you. When you look around and see everyone else's accomplishments and say, oh, well, if they're so much better than me and their accomplishments, and if they're accomplishing and I'm accomplishing, I must be faking it. I must be an imposter. I must be cheating and hoodwinking everyone, because there's no way that I'm on par with that person. And Revolbi says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, no, that's not how it works. And maybe that's the message that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is actually trying to give Moshe Rabbeinu. Let's go back to that Ramban, to the last line, the lines of that first Ramban we saw. I'm back on page 1. Again, in Yud Dalin, Pasuk, Tesvav. It says 5 here, but it's supposed to be 15. My apologies. In the end of the second to last line, after the bold, he says, V'zet ta ma tisak elai, that why does the Kadosh Baruch Hu say, why are you calling out to me? Why Mati Tzakilai? Hai said, Tzarech Lisho Mata Asa, V'in Lo Tzorech Litzok. You could have just asked me. You could have said, God, I'm missing something here. What's going on? You didn't have to call out. You didn't have to scream. You didn't have to freak out. You didn't have to be worried. You didn't have to be filled with anxiety. Ki Kfar Hodiyach V'Chatav V'Parah. I already told you more or less what's going to happen. Lo Sibra Kasav Tzakas Moshe Ki Yubach Lai Sva. And plus, it didn't explain it, that gets into more of a larger point that Ramban's making about the context, but that what Chris Baruch was trying to communicate is, Moshe, don't freak out right now. You're going to be okay. You're fine. You are totally capable of leading Bnei Israel out of Egypt. And you're capable of handling this situation. You don't need to scream at me. Oh, you hit a problem? Yeah, ask a question. But don't worry. Don't have any sort of anxiety that, oh, I'm a fake. I'm an imposter. I'm not supposed to be here. And now everyone's going to see that I'm a fake. And the stakes are so high. God says, you got this. You'll be fine. And the Kliyakar says it even better. And yeah, we have a couple of minutes. We'll appreciate something about the Kliyakar. Kliyakar, he says this comment in Bamidbar about Parshas Kukas, but he's quoting the Medrash here. He says the same thing here. The Kliyakar often has the same comments in more than one place because his commentary is less a commentary, more of Drushos. That whole explanation is more historical and for another time. But the Kliyakar says in Parshas Kukas, and again here, quoting Chazal from the Medrash Tanchuma, I believe. That when a Kodesh Baruch Hu says, V'ataharimis b'antaka, Moshe Rabbeinu, stick out your staff. You know, if we look at the very first page of our source packet, I looked and I could not find a single image that, as far as the Kliyakar is concerned, properly portrays what happened at the Yamsuf. Because we imagine, and all these pictures show us, and all the movies have Moshe Rabbeinu holding out his staff, harimis b'antaka, he points it over the water, and all of a sudden the water splits. Kliyakar says that's not what Hari Matcha means. Lift your staff does not mean lift it up and hold it out over the water. Rather, for some reason it's not bold. Rather, in the second line, Hari Emes Matcha Neteis Yadecha, the Haramazu Lashun Siluk Utruma. What does God want Moshe Rabbeinu to do? Lomar Hari Emes Matcha V'Salkehu. Take your staff and throw it away. Don't hold your staff. And use your own hands. And not with your staff. Because people were saying, that staff Moshe has, it's like a magic wand. All the miracles Moshe performed in Egypt were with his staff. It was some sort of sorcery going on with that very impressive quote-unquote wand. Shehaya lo b'mata, zeh lefi she'eno roin she'en koko ki'im b'mata zeh, that Moshe was nothing. And Moshe, maybe you even heard people saying, oh, Moshe's an imposter. Moshe doesn't really have any kokos. Moshe's not really worthy of leading B'nai Israel. He just has this awesome super geshmak staff. So what does the Kodesh Baruch Hu say? Mati tzakalai, don't call out to me. Don't worry so much. But not just don't call out to me, don't worry so much. Don't have anxiety because you are right to lead B'nai Israel. But God says, I'm going to prove it to you. I'm going to show you. Take that staff of yours that people are talking about, that maybe even you feel is really the cause for all of your success, throw it away. Get rid of it. And effectively what God is saying is, remove from your mind any sort of doubt that you're not supposed to be here. Make it very clear to everyone watching, and to you, Moshe, that you're supposed to be here, that you're good enough, that you're not an imposter. And so we see that imposter syndrome, it's debilitating. It's very challenging. That so many people face it. And some people succeed, but a lot of people unfortunately don't. And so many people struggle from it. Some people for most of their lives, even a third of people. And between 70-85% of people at some point in time do struggle and feel like they're not good enough, that they're an imposter. And it was a struggle for Moshe Rabbeinu. It was a struggle for Shaul HaMelech. It was a struggle for a lot of modern day people, whether it was Annie Duke or Maya Angelou or Albert Einstein or Michelle Obama. And maybe the answer, as Ravolbi points out, like the Kliyakar explains, is to realize that Kodesh Baruch Hu gave you kokos. Kodesh Baruch Hu believes in you. If God believes in you, if God told you can do something, if God put you in this situation to be this kind of, to be a parent of this child, to be a leader of this community, to take on a level of responsibility at work, to be in this group of friends, then you're not an imposter. Then God put you there. God gave you the kokos that you need. You don't need to act or look like anyone else. You're fine just on your own. And maybe with this we'll close. That's what Rabbi Nachman is trying to communicate. Rabbi Nachman has a beautiful line where he says that the day you were born was the day that God decided that the world cannot exist without you. And if we really appreciated that every single day that I wake up, not just the day I'm born, but every morning when I wake up, God's saying the world will be better off with you in it, then maybe I don't need to feel like an imposter. Maybe I can appreciate that I have what to offer, and then I'm not a fraud, I'm not I'm not a fake. I'm not hoodwinking anyone, but that I'm supposed to be here. Thank you so much for learning with me. I'm happy to field any questions. If it's intricate psychological questions, then I will reiterate that I am totally, totally, totally not a registered psychologist in any way, shape, or form. We do have very, very insightful psychologists in the community, and you can talk to Dr. Karish about bringing them in for further sessions. But any thoughts, I'd be happy to share. Thank you so much for learning with me today. Kol tov.
Any questions from anyone?